Sadly, since the last election, the Fresno Bee has worked closely with radical left-wing groups to promote numerous fake news stories about me. Now, I sign up for this job, and I don't mind the attacks. In fact, I find them rather amusing. I haven't said much about the Bee's strange crusade against me, even when Bee reporters went creeping around my neighbors and relatives' homes. But the Bee has now run multiple articles slandering a California agribusiness simply because I'm one of the investors.
California Congressman Devin Nunes has a new campaign ad with an interesting target. It's not his opponent. It's the big newspaper in his district. That ad runs for more than 2 minutes. It's online. It's on TV. It's on the radio. Mackenzie Mays is an investigative reporter at the Bee, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you wrote some of those stories he's talking about, right?
I did, yes.
There's one in particular about a Napa Valley winery. What is that story about?
It was actually a sexual harassment lawsuit against a business that he's invested in. It's a wine business, and it's one of his only assets listed on financial disclosure forms, and it had been settled for an undisclosed amount a few years ago. But it was a really interesting case that involved a fundraiser and a yacht, and there were allegations that some of the top investors in that company were using cocaine on the yacht and also had hired sex workers and some who appeared to be underage. And so the company settled, but it was important because our congressman was an investor. So we wrote about it and we reached out for him for comment multiple times, but we never heard back.
Right. He's one of 50 investors and unlikely to know what was going on that yacht, though, right?
We don't know. We asked, but we didn't get an answer. But yeah, we listed the number of the other investors on there.
And he says there were numerous stories. What other stories is he talking about?
He doesn't specifically say which stories he's saying are false, but obviously none of them are fake. And there's been no demand for some sort of clarification. He talks about a reporter creeping around, I think is the term he uses. And he's referencing a colleague who had done some underground reporting in his city and reached out to community members, which is totally okay and something that we do every day. At the end of the day, we're a local newspaper and we work really hard to get local voices in the stories. So I'm not for sure what he said is a crusade, I think that he calls it, but it's always been reporters' jobs to cover politicians.
What about what he says at the top of that, where he accuses the Bee of working closely with radical left-wing groups to promote numerous fake news stories? Who would these radical left-wing groups be?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I have no idea. I know that we all are trying to get as much truth out as possible. And he hasn't made these claims to me directly or ever really replied to any of my requests for comment, so I wouldn't know.
Now, he is up for re-election, as all members of Congress are this year, and he has raised more than $7 million in this election cycle. And in the past, it was usually between $1 and $2 million or so. So how has he been able to raise so much more money, and is he facing a real threat?
It looks like historically he's never faced any sort of threat. He's pretty easily reelected here, but he does have a big contender that I think we've all written about, and that's Andrew Jans. And he's also raised millions and has gotten some celebrity endorsements and was also just this week endorsed by Elizabeth Warren. So, you know, I can't guess, but I would say that that sort of big push in Nunes's funding is because people might think there is some competition more so than in past years.
I guess he's also running ads against Andrew Jans. Right?
Uh-huh.
Why do you think he's taken out this ad against the Bee?
You know, it's a really interesting time with media and the public officials who respond to the coverage of them. And it's usually the critical coverage that gets called fake news. And I think we've seen this tactic this year. The president has obviously coined that fake news term, but I don't think people were used to that at a local news level. And that sort of changes the game, I think. I think it worries people because we obviously all believe in what we do and we want to be as neutral as possible and tell as much truth as possible. So it doesn't really seem to help anybody to take out an ad against your local newspaper.
Meanwhile, the Federal Election Commission has reported that Nunes's PAC has spent tens of thousands of dollars on Celtics basketball games, on winery tours, hotels, trips to Vegas. Was this all money that Nunes spent on himself?
I know as much as what's in the FEC report. And so, again, those are questions that we'd love to have answered, but he doesn't answer us.
Is that new? Has he answered you in the past, or is that new in the last year or so?
I've been here about 3 years, and I've written multiple stories about him, and he's never replied. Now, I have gotten responses from his spokesperson, but the responses are rarely the answers that I'm looking for. The responses are more criticism of our coverage or why they don't want to speak to the Bee. So I know it's been going on for a few years.
Well, meanwhile, on the editorial side, the Fresno Bee has endorsed Nunes in every election since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not as if the Bee has been a staunch critic all these years of the congressman.
Yeah, that editorial, you know, laid that out. And it was a good piece to reflect on his time here in our region and what the Bee's role in that has been as far as the opinion side. And so, yeah, that is true that the editorial side had endorsed him. And so, you know, it does make you think about some of his accusations as far as us being crusading against him instead of just reporting the news, which is absolutely what we're doing.
Mackenzie Mays, investigative reporter at the Fresno Bee. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, that's Fresno. In other parts of the country, the media is still covering Trump's performance in Helsinki. At first, he said he did not think Russia interfered in the 2016 election, going against what U.S. intelligence agencies say. Then he took it back a day later. He said he misspoke. Yesterday, he told a reporter no when asked if Russia was still a threat. But then the White House walked back that comment, too, saying he said no to answering more questions. But even with all that, supporters of Trump don't seem to mind the president's flip-flops. In fact, it looks like the harsher the criticism, the more devoted his supporters become. Jeremy Peters covers politics for The New York Times. He wrote about this. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, following the summit in Helsinki, it seemed that even the president's biggest supporters were criticizing him. Here's what Fox and Friends had to say.
And I will say this to the president, when Newt Gingrich, when General Jack Keane, when Matt Schlapp say the president fell short and made our intelligence apparatus look bad, I think it's time to pay attention.
Okay, so Trump walked back to his remarks, and according to an Axios poll out today, 79% of Republicans support the Trump-Putin press conference. So how do you explain that?
I think that at this point, people are not reacting to what Trump is actually saying. They are reacting to what they perceive to be an overreaction by Democrats and the media. So, you know, if you're a Trump supporter, you voted for him knowing full well all of his flaws, all of the horrible things that he had said and claimed to have done to women, all of the horrible things he said about his opponents, all of the shady business dealings. You've pretty much come to terms with or are at peace with the fact that this is a highly flawed individual, to put it charitably. So it's going to take a lot to move the needle. I really don't think that unless Trump breaks a crucial campaign promise along the lines of immigration or a social conservative issue like abortion, that he's going to see mass defections from his core supporters.
Do his core supporters say, I don't like him as a person or I don't approve of him personally, but I like his policies?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And to take it a step further than that, what they'll say is, you know, I may not agree with what he's doing, with what he said. I hear all the time when I talk to people, yeah, I wish he didn't tweet so much. But I think that the Democrats and the media's reaction to him is so hysterical that it just makes me kind of discount the criticism. It's almost as if they are being protective of him. And I think that's a real interesting moment for American politics right now, because here you have people who are basically supporting a man out of antipathy to the other side. Now, of course, that's why a lot of them voted for him in the first place, because they couldn't stand Hillary Clinton. But That doesn't make a rock-solid political base, and it certainly doesn't make for a very healthy Republican Party in the long term.
And so his reporters, though, they are conflating the Democrats with the media. They're all in one bucket.
Oh yeah,
to them.
We're all the same, and just as Democrats will accuse some of them at least of Trump of treason, they think the same of us. I mean, it's really one of the I think more corrosive aspects of Trump's criticism of the media when he says, knowing full well that this is not true, that we make things up and we lie and we're purposely distorting the facts to make him look bad. You know, people conflate that with the activity of partisans who are out there trying to discredit the president, and they lump us all together.
Well, I guess given what you just said, why would the president then walk anything back? Why would he this week flip-flop back and forth? Why wouldn't he just stick with what he said in the first place, knowing he won't lose his core supporters?
I think there are these moments, like you saw after Charlottesville, where he does feel the heat. Where that clip you played from Fox and Friends, I think, is a perfect example of when he realizes that he has gone too far and that he's testing the limits of how long is his leash. So you saw that, but President Trump, candidate Trump, businessman Trump has never been a guy who has ever wanted to admit flaw, fault, or apologize for anything. And I think as soon as he gets a chance to say, no, I didn't mean that, he will, and he's done this in the past. He's flat out lied, actually, when confronted with taped evidence. You can say, Mr. President, isn't that your voice on the tape of this pretending to be your own PR agent in the 80s? Mr. President, isn't that your own voice on the Access Hollywood tape? He still, by the way, in private, denies that that is his voice.
So what is the Fox factor in all of this? Are his supporters taking a lot of their opinions from watching Fox News, or are they just not paying as close attention as most of us are in the media, watching cable news all day, reading newspapers, what have you? Are they just too busy to pay close attention to the news stories, or are they just paying attention to one media outlet, and that would be Fox News?
I think it's a combination of those, actually. I think that the average person probably has no idea what it was Trump said at this conference in Helsinki, or that it was actually in Helsinki, or that it was held with Vladimir Putin. I just think that people aren't engaged on that level. However, those who are, I think, are experiencing the news story of what Trump did with Putin and how badly he discredited his own intelligence agencies and people he's appointed to keep this country safe from foreign enemies. They're experiencing it in a completely different way. They're getting a completely different set of facts from blogs, websites, talk radio, news networks. Fox is just a piece of this. Fox doesn't really top more than 2 million viewers on a good night for any of those shows. So there's this whole other media universe that encompasses Breitbart and radio people like Hannity, Mark Levin, Rush Limbaugh, and they are all pretty much saying media hysteria, Democrats calling for his impeachment. And so once again, everybody kind of falls back into their corners, and because of some pretty hyped up, I would say, and a hysterical reaction from Democrats who are likening this to what the Nazis did before World War II. Trump feeds on that, and it discredits the legitimate criticisms of what he has done to the intelligence community.
Jeremy Peters covers politics for the New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Disney is buying Fox. What that means for what you'll see in movie theaters and on TV next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Disney has won the bidding war over much of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. Comcast has dropped out. For $71 billion and change, Disney gets Fox's TV and film studios, including all the movies and TV shows they've produced. It gets the FX and National Geographic cable channels, a majority stake in Hulu, some properties in India and Latin America. Disney and Fox movie studios have earned nearly half of the North American box office this year. However, the big deal is causing some heartburn among executives at those two companies. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. She's been following this story, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hey.
All right, $71 billion and change. That seems like a lot.
Yeah, well, Comcast came in and actually forced Disney to up the price. So even though they didn't actually get Fox, they did make it harder for Disney to buy it.
And there's no pushback from the feds on this. This is going to be approved.
I should think not. Rupert Murdoch, I think, is on awfully good terms with Donald Trump. But, you know, one never 100% knows. But I would think this one gets a quick review and
right.
approval.
Okay. So what does this mean for 21st Century Fox, a big storied name in Hollywood?
Yeah. I mean, legacy film studio going back to the 30s with films like Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, the original Heaven Can Wait, just legacy. It's really upsetting to people who don't even work at Fox to see one of the major studios just vanish. You know, I mean, Disney will do what we don't know quite what it will do at all with this property, but how many movies are they going to need? You know, they've got Marvel movies already. They've got Pixar. They've got Disney Animation. They've got the Lucasfilm Star Wars movies, you know, and then they make the live action Beauty and the Beast or whatever. How many movies are they going to want? What kind of appetite for interesting movies that Fox has made while, you know, other studios have less and less been interested in making different movies? You know, they made The Greatest Showman. I think that was a film that no one would have made. And even though it didn't open that well and people were laughing at it, it had amazing legs. People were passionate about it. And that is just one recent example. So what's going to happen with Fox? It's breaking hearts, honestly, in Hollywood to see it go away.
Right. And will a lot of people be laid off?
Of course, people will lose their jobs. And even in Disney, people are nervous because some of the people at Fox who are high-level executives, I'll single out Peter Rice, who's done important jobs in film and television at Fox. You know, he's considered one of the best assets as an executive in Hollywood. He clearly seems more than likely to have a role at Disney. So who at Disney is not going to have a role at Disney anymore? And this will be a derby to see who succeeds Bob Iger, and Peter Rice is definitely a potential competitor there. So there's anxiety. Not only there, I mean, look at the landscape. AT&T is trying to buy Time Warner. The Trump administration has put, the Justice Department is appealing a decision in favor of the merger. So that will be dragged out months more. So uncertainty there. It is a time of anxiety. You know, Viacom has been in this thing with CBS, whether they merge or don't merge, and does Les Moonves continue at CBS? We're just dealing with this overall anxiety and maybe a sense of injustice that it's just not fair. Because even if you've done an amazing job, I mean, it's always been an insecure industry, but you feel like I killed it and then you're going to get killed because of one of these deals.
Talk about that with regards to HBO, because HBO has killed it. It has brought, well, Game of Thrones, let's just say that.
And it's a cash cow.
Mm-hmm. And also a critical darling, The Sopranos, for example, The Wire, other really great TV shows. And so here the new head in this new world comes in and says to the HBO employees, you're going to have a painful year ahead because we want you to become more like Netflix?
Right. Well, this is John Stankey, who runs what is now called Warner Media, which was Warner Brothers, HBO, Turner, all of these properties that they think they're acquiring, although honestly, months will pass before we know. He gave a town hall with these employees, and he basically said, you know, we need more engagement and we need more, you know, we need people spending hours a day engaging, and we can then use those metrics to sell our ads in a more effective, and it's like this business speak wonky talk.
What does engaging mean? Watching?
Yes, watching. Okay. And really being drawn in and not switching. And And that has not been HBO's thing. And, you know, you can say I want it to be more like Netflix, which, you know, HBO is the crown jewel in this deal. And to sort of come in and say, you're the crown jewel, now let me tell you how bad your year is going to be, doesn't sit well. And bear in mind that Netflix is spending $8 billion on programming, at while HBO has had to do with $2 billion. So the fact that HBO has been profitable and has had this kind of brand that people want to pay for, with that kind of constraint, because Jeff Bukas, who ran Time Warner all this time, has been thinking about selling and not building. So he kept them on a skinny diet. And then to come in and sort of say, well, I'm going to be a little vague about how much more money you're going to get, but we do expect you to compete with Netflix.
And meanwhile, Netflix, this is all because of Netflix, right? Or
yeah, well,
at least
yes.
Netflix is one of the big,
yes, a very big
wolves that they're trying to keep
disruptor.
At bay.
Mm-hmm.
But Netflix loses out on this, right? Because they were carrying Disney properties?
They were going to lose. They're going to lose their Disney programming, and that will be a big thing. And who knows whether Disney can stream Marvel, Lucasfilm, Star Wars, Pixar. They will be a mighty competitor. They're supposed to be the Netflix killer, this deal. And Netflix is spending so aggressively. I think some people are starting to wonder, like, can they keep stacking up subscription growth at a rate that can sustain this? I mean, they just missed some forecasts and their stock got punished this past week. So it's, you know, you might compete yourselves to death in this thing.
Okay, so when all the dust settles, if the dust settles, I don't
someday,
know.
Someday,
there's
yes.
going to be some dust settling eventually. This is going to mean what for us when we turn on our TVs?
I think right now we're going through this confusing time already. Like, okay, I'm paying for Netflix. Do I cut the cord? Do I keep the cord? Do I get CBS All Access because I like Star Trek? I mean, there's like this myriad of choices that you have to make. Ultimately, the herd will thin. Now, for content creators, yay, there's a million buyers desperately trying to find the next thing. But that will end, too. And meanwhile, we are all left saying, what am I paying for? How much do I have to pay for all of this stuff that I have? I love this one thing on HBO. Do I have to pay for the money? What do I do? It's confusing to me.
And you cover it full
and
time.
I cover it, yeah.
You're in it. Okay. Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, are sellers on Amazon getting shadier?
I've started receiving, you know, a dozen hula hoops a week at my office, and I don't know why they're there. Or like, I keep getting, you know, bags of cat litter, and I don't understand why I'm getting them.
That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you think you're seeing a lot more Amazon boxes on porches and around mailboxes this week, well, you're right. The company says it sold more than 100 million items during its Prime Day sale. That's an impressive figure, even if there were a few glitches. But there are some Amazon devotees who have noticed changes at the site. Maybe you're one of them. They say it doesn't feel as friendly as it used to be. Some products don't arrive as promised. The quality is an issue. The gang that produces the Reply All podcast is in that camp, and they try to find out what, if anything, has changed at Amazon. Alex Goldman is one of the co-hosts of Reply All. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Well, what got you started on this project?
What got me started is that I have to confess that I'm not a huge Amazon user.
What?
I'm sorry. I live in the suburbs outside
of
New York.
Un-American of you.
But my coworkers, PJ and Shruti, both found themselves having less than excellent experiences on Amazon. And sort of the catalyst for the story was that Shruti tried to buy an electric toothbrush for her son, which it seems would be very easy, like a one-click buy. And she bought it through Amazon Prime. And when she got it, it was not as advertised. It was a European toothbrush with no adapter. And she was like, what is going on here? Why would I get this when I try and order something through Amazon?
And so, what's the answer?
Well, the answer is kind of complex, honestly. Amazon is sort of growing at an unprecedented rate. It is allowing more sellers from other countries. But with that growth, they are experiencing some quality control issues. And a huge part of it is based on the fact that users can very easily game Amazon search algorithm to make their product, regardless of the quality, appear at the top of the search results.
So it seems like there are two things going on here. There are a lot more third-party vendors and maybe from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying there's a way that they're gaming the system to get at the top of the search.
Yes.
How are they doing that?
Okay, so Amazon search results are heavily based on a variety of factors. And Amazon, of course, does not want anyone to know what those are to make lest they make it more easily gamed. But the one thing that vendors have figured out, that sellers on Amazon have figured out, is that reviews count for a lot. And as a result, this entire underground review buying and selling world has emerged. So vendors will solicit people to get one of their products, say, please buy this product from me, because product reviews from people who've actually bought the product are worth more. And then when the person gets it, they write the review, and then they just charge the company back on PayPal and get their money back plus, you know, $2 or $3. So the person makes a little money, gets something for free, and the vendor gets their product at the top of the listings.
And you talked to a guy, he lives in our area here in LA, and he worked for a company that is trying to sell dryer balls. First of all, what are dryer balls?
They're like a natural replacement for dryer sheets. They're sort of like a fabric softener.
Oh.
I had never heard of them either until I did this story, but apparently there's a big market for them.
So he tries to get his dryer balls to be at the top of the list, and he actually pays for reviews?
Yeah, well, they figured out that if they just bought the product, their own product themselves, and then shipped it to a random address in the U.S., then they could be the ones writing the reviews. So they would buy their own products, just find some random, completely unaffiliated address in the U.S. and ship a bunch of products to them. And in the past year or so, there have been a lot of reports of people saying, hey, I've started receiving, you know, a dozen hula hoops a week at my office, and I don't know why they're there. Or like, I keep getting, you know, bags of cat litter, and I don't understand why I'm getting them. And it's because people are trying to game their reviews, and they need an address to send things to in the U.S. to make it seem legit. So that's what they do.
Oh, my gosh. Is this illegal?
I don't know if it's illegal. It's definitely against the terms of service for the website.
Yeah.
I don't know if it amounts to fraud, but it's
fraud adjacent.
Certainly. It's definitely not above board.
All right. And you talked to another guy who goes by the name of Glue Boy.
Yeah, that was his Reddit username. He promised me that it has nothing to do with drugs, but yeah, Glue Boy.
So that's his nom de guerre, and he writes reviews to make money. Here's a clip.
How much info do the folks who want you to review give you?
Now it's a bit more complicated because they ask you to search kind of a generic term related to the item. And then, you know, click on a few items, look at reviews to so that Amazon doesn't, you know, notice that all of a sudden a bunch of people are going to this product directly.
Do they ask for specific language in the reviews? Are they like, make sure to talk about this particular thing?
Yes, for some sellers. Some sellers will provide they'll give you a review, but those usually sound very artificial, you know, just sound ridiculous reading it like a robot wrote it. Usually it's write your own personal review.
So how are we, the consumer, supposed to figure out if these reviews are legit?
That's a great question. There are a couple of tells that Glue Boy shared with me. He said, don't trust people who review too much. Don't trust people who review too much of the same thing. And the characteristic tell of a fake review is that it's uniformly positive, with the exception of one minor thing that you could easily ignore about the product. So the example he gave me was those things that stick to your dashboard so they can hold your phone. He said that he'll write a review which is like, this thing's great, it works well. Some people have complained that it doesn't stick too well, but you just need to clean the surface first. So everything's positive except for one very ignorable criticism is like a hallmark of a fake review. The other thing that you can do and it's just, it's not perfect, but it's a way to triangulate, is there are a couple of websites that are designed to try and ferret out products that have a lot of fake reviews.
So you do have to do a lot more work.
Yeah, and I think that that's sort of a betrayal of the promise that Amazon held, right? And the part of what actually made this story so frustrating to me is that Amazon, more than most tech companies, is a total black box. They don't really give interviews. They don't give statistics about things like this. And so I am genuinely not sure if what we were – the anecdotes that we collected for the story are indicative of a fundamental shift in the way that this company works, or if these people are outliers and we can still generally trust it. But the fact that people were so willing and able to give specific anecdotes about how the quality has declined over the past few years, it did sort of raise alarms for me. It did make me think like, oh, these people who are actually in this universe recognize that things are actually really bad. And after the episode came out, we did get a lot of emails from people who work as third-party Amazon sellers saying, thank you, everything's gotten so terrible, it's so hard to make money here anymore.
All right. Alex Goldman, co-host of the podcast Reply All. Definitely check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you, Madeline.
And joining us now is Warren Olney with To The Point. Hello.
Hello there. We have a very interesting podcast this week. President Trump, of course, has sowed enormous confusion over whether the Russians are or are not conducting what's a military cyber attack on America's electoral system. Clearly, they are. We're going to go into that in some depth and also talk about the connections that the president has had with Russia going all the way back to 1987, connections that seem to have a lot to do with the personal interests that conflict with the national interests when he's dealing with a lot of subjects.
All right. Thank you very much. Timely, important stuff to
the
point
really is.
With Warren Olney. You can get it as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Warren.
Indeed.
Coming up, an LA woman pushing 40 wants to have a baby. She does not have a man in her life. Time is running out. And so she launched a podcast to find a sperm donor. We'll talk to her next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 2 years ago, actress and comedian Molly Hockey went on The Bachelor.
I'm Molly. I'm 37 years young, and I live in Los Angeles. Being the oldest contestant in Bachelor history is going to be tough, but I'm up for the challenge.
Okay, not really, but she did edit herself into many of the episodes of the show's 20th season, making herself one of the participants competing for Ben Higgins' heart. It was a joke about reality TV and how in The Bachelor's world, 37 is really old. And it's also about the search for a movie-like romantic relationship. Well, now Molly is nearly 40, and she isn't really looking for a relationship anymore. But she does want to have a kid soon, and she's looking for a sperm donor. So she came up with this plan to find him.
Menopause is coming, and the men have all left town. But I'm not giving up until I see that baby crown. 39 and single, can someone help me out?
Yep, that's her singing. She's not singing for her sperm. She started a podcast called Spermcast. Molly Hockey is here now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, Spermcast. So you're like casting for a sperm.
Exactly. Wow, you got it.
Yeah, there's a little pun happening there.
And it's also a podcast.
Gotcha.
Wow.
Okay, but are you serious that you really want a sperm donor and you're doing it through podcasting?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm absolutely looking for a sperm donor, and but I'm at the same time I'm also trying to figure out how to get to a place where I can actually do that, and that's what the podcast is for.
Okay, so the podcast is about the whole process of trying to find a donor.
Well, at first, the idea of having the podcast was really just to interview donors and to have a good time and potentially do this at the end. But it got more serious as I started to think about it more. And then I realized I don't have the money to be a mom. And I just have so much work to do. And I have so much to think about before I can actually make this happen. So the podcast is now my search for a sperm donor, but also my quest for personal growth.
Okay, and you've invited guys, your friends, on to audition them, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, the intention was for in each episode, I would interview a potential sperm donor. And so I started out doing that. And then as I went on, I realized there was a lot to learn about. It's such a, like, a pregnant, oh my God, pun, gross, such a heavy subject. There's so much to learn. And so I've started doing alternating interviews with, like, surrogates and people that have donated sperm to sperm banks and learning about that from the male perspective. And yeah.
So, well, what about going the sperm bank route?
Well, there are pros and cons to both. There's... With known sperm donors, you know exactly what you're getting. You can ask them about their family history, but you can also find out about their mental health and whether or not they have addiction in their family and stuff like that. But if you're going to a sperm bank, you can find out how they are genetically, how their DNA is, you know, how quick their sperm is and how healthy their sperm is and how many they're letting go each time. But, I mean, they don't have to be honest about their mental health. They don't have to be honest about their history with addiction. And I have some of that in my family, and I don't want to pass it on. And I don't want to put my kid through that.
Right.
So that's one reason to go with a known sperm donor. But a great reason to go with a sperm bank is with a known sperm donor, you have more complications, obviously. You're going to have this person that may or may not be in your life. You've got a lot of contracts. Part of me wants an anonymous donor because I don't have to deal with any of the complications of knowing the father. But then I also, it's good to have a known sperm donor because your child isn't wondering their whole life who their dad is or where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. You froze your eggs, right, a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So you were already thinking a few years ago, well, it doesn't look likely that I'm going to have babies the traditional way.
Yeah.
I better plan for this other thing.
Yeah. And I've always wanted to have kids my entire life and never once thought that it wasn't possible or that I was going to get to this point ever. Even when I was freezing my eggs, I was like, yeah, I'll just take a break for a minute, put some eggs on ice and like get to relax for a little while and then I'll have my baby with my man. But the man, where's the man? And it's not that I haven't had great relationships, but they just never turned out the way I wanted them to
It didn't work out for various reasons.
It didn't work out. So, yeah, when I decided to freeze my eggs, it was more of like an insurance policy that because I know this is something that I want in my life. And the second it was done, I felt this massive weight lifted off my shoulders, something that I've been carrying around my whole adult life, this pressure that I couldn't talk about with boyfriends and I couldn't talk about with girlfriends. And I just it was gone. And suddenly I could be myself for the first time in my life. And that's when I ended up doing the bachelor stuff. Because I didn't have to worry about what other people thought about me anymore. I wasn't trying to attract a mate of the father of my child. I just dove headfirst into being creative and really putting myself out there and being unabashedly myself. And it was very freeing. This is not a commercial for egg freezing. There are probably ethical problems with it as well.
And it's unclear if it works, really.
Right, right. It's not...
It's not foolproof.
Right. They don't have a lot of data on the success rates of frozen eggs because it hasn't been around that long. I mean, people haven't come back to get their eggs yet. Or some people find somebody and then they have a baby naturally. Or, yeah, I don't know. We'll find out soon if the whole science is bunk.
Right. All right. So you're going to be 40 this year?
Yeah, in a month and a half.
Do you feel like there's like a real time limit to this whole endeavor?
I do, and it's getting more intense every day. The rate of fertility goes down exponentially, I think, after 35, and it's just down there at 5% now for 40-year-olds. So yeah, I'm starting to get a little scared, and I think this might happen sooner than I realized.
Because you have some candidates.
Because I do have some candidates.
Do you have people who've actually agreed to do it?
So at the end of every episode, I ask everybody to rate their interest in inseminating me on a scale of 1 to 10. And I've had a couple ones. I've had 1.5. I've had a 7. And I've had a 9.9.
9.9?
Yeah.
And how do you feel about the 9.9?
He's great. He's really wonderful. But I'd like to have a few 9.9s. And
well, now you're just being picky.
Well, I can be, though, can't I?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, shouldn't I be? If I have the chance to really select exactly what I want. No, he's wonderful. There's not really a reason to not go with him. But if when I decide on the donor, I'm going to take like basically my top three contenders. I know this sounds strange.
This almost sounds like the Bachelor. There you go.
But I'm going to take my three contenders and we're all going to get blood work and we're going to see whose DNA matches best with mine so that my baby's safe and healthy. And when I froze my eggs, I did genetic testing and found out that I was a carrier of cystic fibrosis and Pompe disease and something called MTHFR and a couple, like four things actually. And I'm nervous about those things and I don't want to pass them on. So I need my donor to not carry any of those genes.
What about psychologically? Are you ready to have a baby by yourself?
That's the big question. This podcast has caused an upheaval of emotions in me and I am screwed up right now. Yeah, I'm really feeling a lot. I did not know that I was going to go through all of these emotions once I started this podcast, but it's really unearthed a lot of feelings that I've been burying for 20 years. About a month into the podcast, my dog passed away that I'd had for 15 years, and that really, really upended me. I mean, I got really very screwed up from that. And I think that combination of the emotions I'm feeling from the podcast and losing my dog of 15 years really, really mixed me up. And for a moment, I thought, I don't want another dependent. You know, for the first time, I don't have somebody to take care of, and maybe I should just take care of myself forever. But I think that was part of the grief, and I don't know. I'm working through it, moving through it. I'm feeling a lot of anxiety lately. I used to have panic disorder from 18 to 24 years old. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, I had my first panic attack in 15 years.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Do you think this is part of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I do. Yeah.
And you don't have a boyfriend or anyone in the picture right now?
I don't. Interestingly enough, at the beginning of the podcast, there was somebody that I was dating who was excited about the podcast because he didn't want more kids. He had a couple kids already.
From a previous marriage.
And he didn't want to have any more. And so the podcast actually allowed us to continue dating because I was like, well, we can just...
He didn't have any problem with you possibly getting
nope.
pregnant by another guy.
Nope. But maybe he did because we're not together anymore. No, but that was more about we weren't on the same timeline. He hadn't processed his divorce yet mentally. He needed more uh-huh. space. And I'm like, get me into your house. I'll take care of your kids. I mean, I didn't say any of that. Oh, no. Is he going to hear this? Probably. That's okay.
Well, yeah. So there is that option, too, that you could find a guy who already has kids and be a mom to them.
Yeah.
You could adopt.
Still have this need. It's so annoying, this need. I should adopt. After I have my first baby, then I'll adopt another one. But I have to have a little more money first.
Well, is part of this podcast part of that? Like you're just, I mean, I don't want to be cynical about it, but it's a way to make money.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not ashamed to say it. When I first started the podcast, I have a naivete. I'm just a very positive person. And part of my naivete convinced me that I would start this podcast and I would make millions of dollars and I could afford to have a baby. And so here I am on KCRW.
I hate to break it to you.
You guys don't have a ton of money at
but
KCRW.
Podcasting is not the road to riches.
It might be. We don't know. Oh, you might be right. See, I'm learning. Look, as it's gone on, I've realized that my lofty dreams, you know, I'm a little bit more grounded now. And it's all a process. I'm learning so much as I go along. The other thing that has been really exciting for me is talking to women and men and hearing from men and women that feel the same way as me and and this is resonating with them so much. I knew it would strike a chord with women all over the world, but I didn't know it would affect men. And I've gotten emails from men who are in their late 40s who, you know, have never wanted kids that have told me that my podcast is making them see things in a different light, a way they've never seen it before. And it's really... It really motivates me and makes me want to continue doing this when it's very stressful, actually.
Yeah.
But
Are you getting strange men? I mean, I don't mean strange men, but strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am excited to tell you that in the last week, because there was a Washington Post article about it last week, uh-huh. about the podcast, I've gotten a couple emails from men I've never met before, and it is interesting.
Offering to help you out?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm probably going to talk to them this week. But yeah, I haven't really talked to them yet, so I don't know what it's all about. But they're confused too. They're like, I don't know you. I don't know why I'm doing this.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, I've never written an email like this. This is so strange, but I feel compelled to offer you my sperm.
Well, that's lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Molly, I'm dying to find out what happens. When will we know for sure?
I don't have a deadline, but I really want to do it sooner than later. I think it kind of depends on my finances. So everybody, SpermCast, take a listen and share it with your friends.
And maybe you'll be moved to donate.
Oh.
Molly Hockey, she's an actress, comedian, and host of the new podcast, SpermCast. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. This was such a joy.
Top that, Christian Bordahl.
I can't. I don't even know where to begin. Well, we did have some reaction to the idea of sperm donation.
I'm sure.
Angie Lenhart says, this is fabulous. Choosing to be a mother is a loving, challenging, noble pursuit. No reason to wait if the right partner hasn't come into your life. Andrew Spivak says, single motherhood is the worst thing you can do to a child. Find a husband. That's a little harsh, Andrew. So okay. Susan Arick responded, the wrong husband is the worst thing you can do to a child. Josh Parker says, yikes, don't do it, guys. Never donate your sperm. That's like handing out blank checks with your signature on them. Molly Hawkey herself responded, don't listen to him, guys. Do it.
I guess he's not in the offing.
Right.
He's off the list.
Well, there does seem to be a concern out there among guys that if you donate sperm, even anonymously, to a sperm bank, you might end up on the hook for child support. So I looked that up, and mm-hmm. California law apparently protects sperm donors from parental responsibilities, as well as protecting intended parents from a claim of parentage from a sperm donor.
Oh.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So it goes both ways.
So I asked, you know, I put out a little tweet poll. And I said, would you donate sperm or use sperm from a donor to get pregnant? 39% said, sure, why not? Sounds good. 19% said, only if I know the donor or the recipient. 11% said, only if I don't know the donor or recipient. And 31% said, no way, Jose, not going there. So there you go.
Okay, people have strong opinions on sperm, it turns out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
okay.
You, Madeline?
Whoops, the show's over.
Yes,
Christian Bordahl, thank you for coming in today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.